How long were you sitting in the car, eating guilt slushy, instead of recording podcasts with me? This is ridiculous. You say you're going to adhere to thing, and then you sit in car, drinking slushy like guilty child finding Christmas presents, or trying to inform on Soviets.
Hey, look, we're only an hour and 14 minutes late starting recording. That's really good for me, you have to admit.
This is big slushy.
Howdy, everyone. Welcome to the Contextual Insurgent Podcast. As you've probably guessed, I'm once again joined by Tech Bro Tito, as usual. Yeah, today we were, it was a little late to start, but it was pretty good for me. It was only a little over an hour there, because I had to sneak off to get some water from the local store, some of the nice filtered water. I just hate the tap water here. And I couldn't help but dip into a little Coca-Cola slushy, and, that was, I got caught in the car drinking it down. And
this is why you're a merfat. This is why a miracle will never amount to anything. It lacks discipline.
Yes, we are not disciplined people here in the land of plenty. You know, the whole thing, what was it? It wasn't Gorbachev. It was, Brezhnev or something came to the, during the Reagan years, he showed up in a supermarket and was like, had the holy fuck looking expression on his face of like, everything was packed with good, you know, goody goodies and everything.
Do you really need 50 brands of toothpaste?
Yeah, I know, it's true. But then again, when you think about it, too, it's like Americans were really skinny then, too, and it's weird. And now we can't get infant formula in the store, so I don't know. We'll see how fat Americans stay for very long. Oh, your puppy dog shaking. Sorry. My puppy dog is shaking hands now. She's woken up from her nap and is deciding to shake hands. Anyway, we're getting off here again. A wild bit of divergence for the start of this podcast. We were talking about the Twitter files, which kind of past weekend were a pretty remarkable set of documents from the inside of Twitter. It kind of laid out kind of the evolution of their moderation over the past few years from the Trump years and the little things they do in the back end that can, you know, change the level of amplification and searches and all the weird little tweaks they do to the algo in the back end. So some people can get more follows and likes and more spread via the feed than other people. And also had some really interesting discussions of dealing with banning Trump and disciplining everyone, and especially the Hunter Biden files. There was a lot of interesting stuff, with that and everything with the lead up to it. And there's tons of stuff. It's like the thing for me is the files themselves were pretty interesting. They just really kind of confirmed a lot of the stuff most people kind of already knew. And it wasn't so much the files themselves that really impressed me. The excerpts from the chat, the Slack chats they have and their internal documents. But a lot of it for me was more about the way they were thinking and a lot of the reactions to the files themselves from a lot of very prominent people. We'll get more into that, though. But when you were reading over, what did you think there, Tech Bro? What were your basic takeaways?
Well, I think the Twitter files, they're less interesting, less explosive than expected. And I think this goes back, I wish to not get too far astray, but it's worthwhile going back through a recent history of leaks, right? You have WikiLeaks, which becomes very big, sort of becomes the essentially gold standard in the recent past for sorts of leaked things. Aha, you have Collateral Murder, which is most a famous one, but you also have the Cablegate leak.
Yeah, the Collateral Murder, that was the video of like the Reuters team getting shot by an Apache, I think.
Like that, right? Yeah. But what you see from the helicopter person is helicopter person says, yeah, it does look like a long thing, and they shoot at it and they laugh about it. But with Collateral Murder,
yeah, they had a camera. They had it was a tripod for a camera, and they were like running around filming stuff or whatever, and they plastered them with a 30mm cannon.
And they left, but the thing was, it exposed was, the helicopter crew did think these were combatants, was not splattering journalists, was splattering combatants that they thought were on battlefield, and did it. It's just they took a rather gallows humor approach to killing what turned out to be journalists. This is what one of the big things that launched WikiLeaks. Or in public consciousness. Many people knew about WikiLeaks before, myself included. Then you sort of have the Snowden revelations. The Snowden revelations, don't actually get as wide of press and all this, aren't covered quite, as extensively, nor is there smoking guns, nor do they reveal things. It pushes some back, but ultimately outcome of the Snowden leaks, which are far more extensive over a far greater time than WikiLeaks, really results in perhaps Rand Paul getting elected, his anti-drone filibuster on floor of Senate. This is really, and then you have, of course, Snowden being in Russia, being hosted by some people, yada yada yada. Perhaps some more interest in privacy, PGP or Tails OS or Zcash, which he partially wrote protocol for. Again, all these things most people don't know about because impact wasn't that big. Twitter files, I think, starts to become more like this. And you have much less of the impacts of, say, Watergate. You have much less of impacts of, say, Nuremberg trials. You have much less impact of things. And why is that? And I think what this reveals, right, is basically we know much of what motivates. It's really that what you see is people do believe what they're doing is correct. They don't believe that they're being evil. There's going to be no smoking gun in the future of, we did evil things. I mean, this goes with the Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX leaks that we've seen so far. There's no smoking gun. People want smoking gun. They want a televised thing. They want, Nixon talking on a radio on things. And that doesn't exist anymore. I think Watergate was misinterpreted in many ways. Point is this. You're not going to get easy soundbite kind of things, that anything but salacious things that are irrelevant to discussion. What I think is more revealing about leaks is it shows essentially that there is no such standard. There is no ability, really, to be arbiter of algorithms without being decider. And that when people maybe want a consensus reality, they want consensus from 50s or 70s. This has more to do with fact United States had more consensus, had more stability, had more things in common with each other back in day than they do today. And so reality is not consensus. People do live so differently and live such different lives. It's so much more heterogeneous, and it is so much less homogeneous. You will not have homogeneous understanding. You will not have homogeneity. And I think anyone that approaches Twitter and approaches news platforms and approaches reporting and says it can be unbiased, it can be, Walter Cronkite of old, it can be this, simply doesn't understand that these are reflections of Walter Cronkite, old CBS and all this. This is a reflection of homogeneous reality, not making homogeneous reality.
Yeah, I had to reach over and take the collar off my puppy dog because she decided to wake up and start rolling around, and it was hearing the jingle, jingle, jingle on the collar. Here, throw this on her and send her out of the room. Here, put that on her. So I'm going to put the collar back on my dog and send her out of the room really quick. The thing that's interesting to me about, Tech Bro mentioned collateral murder, which was, we're not going to get off into that because that's not the primary topic of this. It's really interesting and informed because obviously they did not think, hey, there's some journos, let's go waste them with the machine gun on the bottom of my helicopter. No, they were like, hey, those are some unknowns, and they had a tripod and a camera they were carrying. And, if you're bouncing around a helicopter, 2,000 feet above the ground, and you see a bunch of figures, and you're in a war zone, and you see something it's really interesting. We're not going to delve into that, but that's a really interesting thing if you ever study on cognitive biases. Because if you're in a war zone, and you're expecting people to run around with RPGs and machine guns, and someone pulls out something that's roughly shaped like that, then you're going to see a weapon, even if it's not a weapon, if you're primed to see that. And that's a really interesting divergence into, or we could have that. We're not going to do that because that's a totally different topic.
Totally different topic.
Yeah, but no, that's always an intriguing thing. I've used that as an example before when talking to people. But no, the interesting thing, you know, again, I agree so much on what you were saying about, you know, consensus reality, and, you know, it's like, who's reality? That's the problem. It's like, whose reality we're going to depend on. It's one thing if in the past, you know, if you've read like McLuhan or Bernays or anyone who's ever talked about like mass media and mass democracy and the problems with that, you know, it's like, well, now you kind of, because of the way the internet is structured, it's impossible not to see the sausage being made, because there's no, you know, funnel of consensus reality pouring out of a handful of news networks. Now you've got the internet, and now you have people that are able to form their own consensus reality, you know, where it's much, much harder to try to interfere with that. I mean, you know, and you see when they do try this, with Twitter, you know, most, that's really what you're seeing. Like, there's the object level and there's the meta level. The object level is, you know, kind of in the weeds of what the files were showing. But like the meta level of what you're seeing is a group of people that are trying to enforce a consensus reality. And when people in general don't really want to accept the consensus of reality, they have a separate consensus of reality. And that's part of the issue, too, is one of the things that stands out to me with it, as, you know, again, having lived in the Bay, and, you know, what I see in the files are not anything that really surprises me. Like, these are people who have a set of values and an ideology that wildly diverges from the rest of the country.
Right.
And they live in the Bay, so it's like they're surrounded by people who think like them. And they don't think that it's unusual, because everyone around them in their social milieu and in their area, their region, and everyone they see, like, thinks like them. But more importantly, these people, everyone you see really trying to enforce the high-level policies that they're trying to push, they're not just a regional identity, but there's also kind of a sort of a class identity. They're all PMC people. They're the professional managerial class of people.
Let's be very clear here. If I gave you, you know, if you know, the Matrix is famous, of course, for a red pill meme on the right, you know, you can take a red pill, you can wake up and see how reality truly is, or you can take blue pill, you go back, your life doesn't change, and you know, everything remains normal. You take the red pill, you go down the rabbit hole and see how far down the hole it really goes. Well, okay, this is in fact false choice. Let, you know, John Anderson, or Neo as you know him from Matrix, he isn't living a very happy life. He doesn't like it. So this is already weighted towards him. Again, this is what consensus reality is. He is not living within consensus reality. He is in fact dissident. He is in fact disinterested, disgusted, unhappy with current reality. So when he's offered a choice to hit button to change reality, or to keep reality the same, this is not a neutral choice by a neutral arbiter, a neutral person, truly 50-50. You know, and so people like to act like everyone is that way. Simply not true. You know, simply put, let me give you choice, okay? You know, I gave you choice. You know, you take the blue pill, you take the red pill, and you take the red pill, and you see the truth, you see how far down reality really goes. But I will half your net worth. I will cut your net worth in half. You will lose half your friends. And you will not find any job as good as you currently have. You have a 50-50 chance of losing your current job, and you have a 50-50 chance of losing your wife or significant other. Or you take the blue pill, you continue as you are, and perhaps you get a $50,000 a year raise. Which do you choose? Okay, that's for you. Now ask this about members of your family. Not people that you choose that are friends, but people that you are related to. Ask what percentage would fall on that. This is the problem with Matrix. People act like truth has its own revealing ability, that truth is this razor, Hanlon's razor, that will reveal everything, the truth. It's this enlightenment principle that suddenly the truth will out. This is simply untrue. James Burnham talked about this back in Suicide of the West, book I am currently reading again to understand your perspectives and to see his criticisms of communism, which are very enlightening, very, very engaging writer. But point is, truth itself does not reveal. And so the thing is, you know, these people aren't just living, you know, it's just not, oh, not just their bubble, we need to interrupt their bubble. No, ask one step further. If they actually question these dogmas, if they actually, if they actually think differently or question these things, does it threaten their well-being? Does it threaten their livelihood? Does it threaten their social standing? Does it threaten their income? If so, why in the world would they agree to it?
No, that's a good point. It's like, you know, we both know people in the tech industry. They're, you know, maybe not even radicals by any modern sense of the word. Even by, you know, if you look at broad ideology in the West or even in the United States, some of the people I know that, you know, I wouldn't consider them extremists in any sense of that word. But at the same time, the things that they happen to believe are so far out of step with what a lot of people in a lot of these this class of people, but also this industry. At least, like, you know, it's really interesting because we're seeing a lot of this with Elon. It's like, you know, there's a tension between the managerialist class, the people, like, the people that are, you know, not the founders of the companies. They're not people like Elon or Mark Andreessen or David Sachs or anything like that. They're not the VC people, but they're this class of kind of worker bees below those. And they have, you know, this like this weird class identity, and it's a shared ideology that's almost like religious. You know, in fact, it probably, I hate to say religious because I don't think wokeness is itself, or people call it a religion, and I think that's close, but I think
it's a moral code is more what it is.
There's that's, you know, a lot of that. I think the religion thing's a little overblown because I think it's more of, I think it's a brain worm that kind of fills the gap left by religion. Right. Religion is kind of like a code that, amongst other things, you know, it kind of jams that part of the brain that is susceptible to that sort of thinking.
But I think problem is that with religion, you actually have, and this is where conservatives again confuse themselves. They think that exactly what left has is untrue, and similarly left to right. I was trying to explain an analogy for instance, of trying to find essentially the equivalent of essentially far left crazy racist podcasting. You know, you can find crazy racist podcasts on the right that sound, that say all the, hit all the Nazi notes you wish to hit for your radical far-right stuff. And he wanted to see what the equivalent on left was of the horseshoe theory of the two meeting. And I really had to explain to him, well, you can sort of look at Chapel Trap House, you can look at other things that are anti-fascist podcasts, but point is, they don't exist in the same way. The right likes to essentially get its emotions out in podcasts, and so that frankly, the motifs and the kind of emotional notes that the right hits far more on anger, hits far more on aggrievement, hits far more on power and, you know, and just a sentiment, as it were, whereas left tends to be far more policy-focused, and they get their emotional catharsis out in person, usually, and so they fill different needs. And so similarly, what I'm saying is this, the left and right think differently, so a moral code is enough. They don't need to believe it. They don't need to believe that a woman is that a woman can become a woman just by saying she's a woman in magic words. They don't need to believe this. They need to believe that that for society, for the moral code, for the functioning of society, it's better for this, and they are better people for doing it and striving themselves as much as possible. But they don't need to interrogate too deeply into their hearts, which of course is the very opposite of Christians, who believe that, you know, deep down to the moral level of their hearts, that they're bad, corrupt people, original sin and all this, and that they need essentially Jesus to intervene, because no matter how much they scrub, no matter how virtuous they are, all those little doubts, all those little problems, all those little sins they do, that itself will essentially, make them unelect, and it sort of takes the intervention of Jesus himself to be able to make them pure in the eyes of God. And they have to believe this, right? The belief. That does not necessarily need to exist for the far left. And so it's more of a code. You know, it is code. You behave this way, you do this kind of thing. It's like an etiquette. It's an etiquette or a code. It's a social code to make interoperability better. You don't have to believe in the same way. And so when you have people like Crowder or other people hit college students that believe this, it's funny to laugh at. But most of the people at the top don't necessarily truly believe it. They just act upon it.
No, that's a good point. You know, I think that's one of the things, too, and, you know, drifting a little bit, but it's fine, so what if we drift? One of the things that stands out to me, again, like, I don't think it's wokeness is a religion per se. I think one of the things you, and this is one of the things that I've come to kind of consider, believe over the time. Folks have been debating this stuff, like, you know, and you see a lot of folks like James Lindsay and other people, the academics who are approaching it, and like Wesley Yang, for example, kind of approaching it like a religious substitute. And I think one of the things with that is, you know, and there's other people who think it's just a cynical power play. And I'm like, well, you know, it could be all these things that people are seeing. I think part of it is you have people with different backgrounds that are approaching it like this. You know, and they're seeing it through a schema that's part of their background, and they see it like, hey, this is it's a religion. Oh no, it's not. It's just a cynical power play. I'm like, well, yeah, it's like all of these things. Like you've got people who literally, like, I remember seeing, you know, I've talked with this before. It's like I saw this girl in Berkeley in 2017 who was with RevCom, the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is. It's literally like communism. It's like a communist scientific, like they literally are a cult. They've got like this cult leader guy, Bob Avakian. It's just some crazy shit. But again, it's all far left Berkeley communism. But no, she was like having something that looked like a Pentecostal, like speaking in tongues moment. You know, she was just like crying and shaking and was like having this like just sputtering. And I don't know if she was having a seizure or maybe she worked herself up into a seizure. But it was just had this truly, like, it was, I thought she was going to do that thing. Like, what's the guy named Benny, whatever his name is. Fuck, I can't remember. The guy with the white suit and silver hair that's always, like, touching people and calling them healed and stuff. The crazy
faith healer
dude. Yeah, he's, like, on TV all the time. Benny something. I almost meant to say Benihana, but no, that's the place where people go to eat. And, like, it's something like that. Benny something. But yeah, that guy, like, it looked like she was at one of his, like, you know, faith healing event thingies.
Benny Hinn?
Benny Hinn, that's it. It was an H, and I was like, it's a Benny Hinn. Yeah, and I was like, it's not Benihana, because that's where people eat at, but it's like that. It's so close. And I'm like, it's Benny Hinn. Yeah, that's it. Thank you so much. Yeah. It was close, though, right? I was close. I was
unfamiliar with this.
Benihana?
Oh, supposed yeah. Christian doing the miracles for money, essentially.
It's like, yeah, we're going to go worship at Benihana. And people are like, what? We're going to go to church. We're going to Benihana.
Perhaps an Idiocracy version of Coming Future.
Yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, Benny Hinn, that makes a really, really nice, you know, well, no, it's just like a seafood place, right? Like a really nice California roll at Benny Hinn's.
They don't do rolls. They cook food in front of you. Yes. Sushi is not cooked.
It's not sushi, but it's cooked food.
It is hot surface on table.
It's the hot surface.
It's the hot surface on the table thing.
You're getting harassed by the Japanese chef.
It's hibachi. Hibachi grill is what it's called. Okay. So yes. In future, we worship at Benny at Benihana. People will believe that all tables had heating elements, and so every night people would put their hands on hot table to atone for sins.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That probably is going to get mashed up some way in the future, and people think that's what everything's a religious ritual.
Back to point. So
okay, go ahead.
Well, I just you know I was. You tried to provide structure, I tried to provide, color commentary. We're going on and on enough, let me provide structure, you provide color commentary, apparently.
Yes. I like this, so, this is fun.
Number one was Twitter Files by Matt Taibbi, talking about what was held back, talking about public policy, talking about Kayleigh McEnany, who was banned from Twitter about things, and so it was basically a high level overview of how they handled hacking and such like that. Number two is my favorite. It was covered by Barry Weiss, which was the secret blacklists, and so I'll give my commentary on that after. Just very very high level overview. Number three was Matt Taibbi, Twitter Files: Removal Donald Trump Part One. So October 2020 to January 6, covering essentially. The discussion inside Twitter of what they saw, could they ban him, could they not, they did not, you know, ultimately these times, obviously, but they were talking about it and, you know, doing these things and starting to build up essentially the momentum idea essentially behind banning Donald Trump, The Twitter Files Part 4 was Michael Schellenberger. The removal of Donald Trump on January 7th about how the Twitter's executives build weight for a ban and how they change policies and they get very excited and policy wonkery about how it makes it closer to being able to ban Donald Trump while not quite banning Donald Trump and people getting banned for Donald Trump things. And then finally, as of this publishing, we have the Twitter Files Part 5, again by Barry Weiss, the removal of Donald Trump from Twitter on that perspective, going through those things. And again, they go into minute detail. And again, I think problem is to report on something of this this kind of depth, you run into the same problem that that Snowden did. And I honestly believe part of problem with Snowden leaks, quite simply, was you needed to essentially have establishment buy-in by the people that knew policy areas to report and to make a particular fiefdom to find the files for Snowden to have figured out which fiefdom they could report on that was specifically their area of expertise, public policy, people to know, people way to report it, and people to amplify it. The entire, essentially, order of battle. Essentially, you needed to give tanks to the person who knew how to use tanks. You needed to give APCs to the person who knew how to use APCs. You needed to give the special operations that are up behind the enemy lines first to people with spec ops backgrounds. You needed to get this right, and you needed to have diversified people reporting these things as an order of battle to really get full warfare effects. And so I think ultimately with Snowden, I'm not sure there were enough people in these areas of expertise willing to help. And I think similar thing with the Twitter files is I don't know if there's people that are, area experts, to know how to report on them, and to really, it takes a sort of nuanced approach to know how to approach these things. So for me, as I said, I found the Twitter files number 2 to be sort of the most enlightening. Other people may take issue with that, that's fine, about the secret blacklists. And I find that most revealing, right? Because specifically during the several years, people asked if people were being blacklisted or shadow banned. They asked about shadow banning very often. And so what I've heard is you had everyone from Vijaya, she was the horrible woman interviewed on Joe Rogan by Tim Pool, and Tim Pool nails her to wall, very good interview. I helped launch his really popular part of career. Of course, some of us have followed Tim Pool for much longer. And she was head of trust and safety left, and she's been neck deep in everything revealed about, perhaps skullduggery of Twitter. The point is this. They apparently use shadow ban in different way, and I've heard some people say, Twitter I've been reading, some people say that Twitter actually published that shadow ban means a very specific thing, very specific context, and this was all public, it was just buried in blogs, and most people didn't know this, and so Twitter thought they were being open, but it was just, while it was publicly available, it wasn't publicly known. And so then Twitter was able to think that since everything was technically publicly available, but not publicly known, that doing these things and using these particular words, it didn't mean things. So essentially, shadow ban means a very specific thing. It means that people can't find you by search, and all this. But de-amplifying, this being messing with the algorithm so that you won't trend, or people outside certain groups won't see you, or other ways of messing with the algorithm, that is not called shadow banning. It has various different terms and various different levels, very nuanced and very granular ways to affect. So when people said they weren't shadow banning, this is what normal people thought they meant, but they only meant a very specific thing, and there were like essentially 50 other terms, 50 other ways they could essentially mess with your reach on the platform that were not being addressed by this question.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, there's so many good points you've raised there, and this is several of these things that we've touched on before in writing and in podcasts. They do this thing, and of course Michael Anton talked about this. This is kind of, it's kind of related to what he says about, it's like that it's not happening and it's good that it is that little, that celebration parallax thing he talks about. And this is kind of what they do. It's like, they'll say, hey, we're being shadow banned. No one can find me. And they're like, no, we don't shadow ban. That's not something we do. And then you're like, wait, this got leaked and this shows you're doing exactly what I accused you of. And they're like, no, it's called this. And we never said we didn't do it. Look, if you read, paragraph 534 in our terms of service on page, 57, here there's this clause that we reserve the right to de-amplify you.
No, we reserve the right to protect the algorithm from negative publicity effects. Yeah. In which case, this is covered.
They will not. This is not a conspiracy theory. You're making something that we've never hidden before because it's here in the
toss. We said for reputational protection that we reserve the right to alter the algorithm any way we saw fit. This is covered under this section, right? And so then you have essentially a couple different things. One, you have you're redefining it, a common use term in a way people don't understand, and then two, them covering it in sort of new language, mushy language. And the language that isn't necessarily...
It's the difference between, like, colloquial and technical language. It's like they're willing to... And this is, again, this is something I've covered before, is the difference between a colloquial term, which is kind of just, you know, the one that people have kind of developed organically over time, and there's the technical term. Right. It's like a lot of these people, they're willing to switch back and forth between the terms, depending on what allows them to deny things and what allows them to kind of, you know, cloud the water with squid ink.
Well, and so I think most famous example, of course, of this is Bill Clinton. It depends on what the definition is. Or I did not have sexual relations with that woman, and he explained it from his simple homespun country boy southern background. Unless you had sexual intercourse with woman, it was not sexual relations. Perhaps it was sexual like, or perhaps it was sexual in nature, but it was not sexual relations, see? So getting a bit of a humdinger and a cigar going places, well, as long as the two are not connected, as long as you get close but no cigar, or cigar but no no sausage, as it were, as long as it's cigar and no sausage, it does not count as sexual relations, which is of course not how normal people understand it. He was widely mocked and criticized for this and seen as this kind of a squirming, but since then it has essentially become normalized, and the terms of service has become normalized in terms of that. Yes, you must understand these incredibly strange and perfidious ways of defining and redefining things is just how things are, and that terms can be redefined several times over your course of your lifetime. If you question this, there's a problem with you. You know, it's famous thing. I've seen watching videos on Catherine on Hochul, Governor Hochul of New York, and how she was nearly defeated by Lee Zeldin as New York governor, but she was giving a speech in front of a podium that said, like, you know, new gun safety measures. And so this is something the left has done for decades, right? What is gun safety? Well, gun safety, if you shoot firearms, is, you know, the four rules, you know, set down by Jeff Cooper. It's making sure that your it's making sure that your trigger discipline is excellent, making sure you know squib rounds, and making sure that things don't need to cook off. All these kinds of things. You know, this is gun safety, right? How to handle a gun safely, how to use it effectively, etc. That is gun safety for people that are knowledgeable about guns. The left has now tried to back away from the term gun control because it's seen as a problem, and they've attempted to co-opt and change term to gun safety, meaning gun control. And you can see again, this is something that recently was beat back, and of course it is a right-wing conspiracy to say this is a thing, but trying to make minor attracted persons a new word for pedophile, right? So this is actually a consistent thing, right? Creating new terms, and frankly, in American discourse, it is the same as, you know, whether you call someone African-American today, or if you call them black, you certainly can't call them Negro. And there is by no means can you use the other word that starts with N. Oh my God! Kanye, of course, is gay, has actually talked about this. Again, part of what I find interesting about him. Maybe he's wrong on many things. Maybe he says disgusting, terrible things. But, you know, the weaponization of language and the changing and the continuing to change terms. You know, it was a clinical term to refer to people with IQs under 100 by three different terms. You had idiots, you had morons, and then you had the word retard. These all had specific meanings within IQ. Well, what happens is now, in some circles anyway, the retard or retarded is actually considered to be slur. And it's considered to be wrong, and you need to move to intellectually disabled or whatever. And they keep changing terms. But in fact, it's used for safety, it's used to make people feel better and all this. But the point is, it creates a disjuncture and inability to discuss what came before. And it's a way of essentially de-boosting and changing and making it so that the scholarship records of people having robust debates on something are harder to find and harder to remember, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think the thing that, the biggest takeaways I have from the files, it's not really what was in the files themselves. It was, you know, you have this groupthink, but then you also have, you know, they were talking about the relationship between the Democratic administration and political activists and the people at Twitter. And a lot of these people, you know, there's so much overlap. And I think that's something to recognize there, is that, you know, these people are, because of the places where they live and, you know, the sentiments that you're likely to see if you're a white urbanoid type person, you know, you're not likely to be a conservative. It's very rare to find that, where a white person is like, oh, hey, I'm going to move to a big city and live in a coastal city. It's a very, such a Republican place. You know, it's one of those things that sorts for very lib sort of sensibilities. And you see that where, of course, you're going to have so much interplay between the Democratic activists and the Democratic think tankers and the tech industry at that level, like the PMC class. There's so much overlap there. Another thing, you know, it's interesting because you see that, because it's you know, as we've always said, you know, it's personnel is policy. So if you've got this revolving door between the Democratic Party, like activist group, and a lot of these tech companies, well, what do you think is going to happen? You know, these people that are setting the tone for entire organizations are all Democratic activists and donors and you know, Democratic operatives at some point in their career, because there's a lot of people who do that. They go from, like, you know, Center for American Progress, and then they go work at a tech company or something, or they work in an administration somewhere. You see that sort of thing, because these companies are in places that are going to draw, you know, a certain, overwhelmingly draw from a certain set of ideology, someone who's inclined towards being a lib, you know.
Right, and I, again, I just wish to push on that again. Mm-hmm. One of the problems of talking to blunt as hammers right-wingers is they wish to understand things as yes, no, on, off. It's all about money, it's not about money. It's about a religion, it's not a religion. And they wish to see things in very blunt, black-and-white terms. And you have to understand, think of the liberal, you know, think of all that kind of stuff, right? They like to see things more in terms of gray. Even if they're bad at it, even if you're a stupid liberal, even if you're one that's truly just dumb, okay? Even if you know the one that's truly dumb, the way they gain clout, the way they gain status, the way they seem to be so clever, right, is they attempt to say, well, there's different ways of looking at it, it depends. They attempt to create multiple gradations, right? You know, I think you're famous for popularizing phrase that the left views violence as a knob and the right views violence as a switch, on off.
Yeah.
Let me go one step further.
Larry actually got that from me.
Yes, Larry Correa got that from you. Very, very cool. Let me go one step further.
I didn't realize that until you told me that later. It was funny. He was like, oh, I was like, wow, Larry's saying that. And then I remembered I'd said that at one point, and he later said, yeah, I got that from you. I was like, oh, okay.
Very cool.
Yeah.
But let me actually reform that and actually expand it. Okay? The left views most things as a knob, and the right views most things as a switch. This is a very very fundamental difference in mentality and ideology, okay? The left sees violence in words. The left sees violence in weapons. The left sees violence in people using weapons. All of these things are different levels of violence. And in fact, so the thing is, they see the ability not just to shadow ban, but to deboost, to search ban, or search blacklist, is what she said happened to Dan Bongino. They like the idea of having gradations and having these kinds of things. Whereas the right simply says, was I shadow banned or not? And so when you actually think of these people, you have to think that they're going, that they don't want one solution. They want 50 solutions. Because then that justifies more complexity, that justifies more budget, that just justifies the kind of thing. And it's a very different way of thinking. And so if you continue to think, well, yes, no, blah, 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 you will completely misunderstand the enemy, and you will completely, you know, completely fail to understand. Again, you know, it's much like Zeno's paradox, okay? It's the right thinks like a person, like a contractor. Oh, I measure from here to here, it's 5 feet. And I take the tape measure, and I measure it, and it hits wool, I hit 5 feet. The left likes to think in Zeno's paradox. Well, to cross those 5 feet, First, I must have the distance, the 2.5 feet. And then to get the next distance from the 2.5 feet I am from the wall, I must have that again to 1.25 feet. And then to get from that distance again to go from 1.25 feet, I have to half that distance again to 0.75 feet. And it keeps going on and on and on. And this is a famous Greek paradox from Zeno. And the idea is essentially, in Zeno's paradox, to get from point A to point B, first you must half the distance between the two. But the idea is, if you continually halve the distance, you'll never ultimately reach your target. So how do you reach your target if first you have to halve the distance? It's a logical paradox. There's no answer to it. It's remained unanswered. People propose answers, but there's no definitive answer to it. And it's remained this way for thousands of years. This is much closer to the way the left thinks. And the right really has trouble entertaining this kind of gray area and this kind of undecidedness aspect to it. But that is at the heart of trying to understand leftist ideology and thoughts.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, and you see this, where lefties really kind of work in networks. And they understand and appreciate networks a lot. Because, you know, again, people are like, oh, was I shadow banned? Well, maybe you weren't shadow banned. Maybe you aren't banned. But maybe there's someone between you and a different network of people who was a transmission node for your ideas to a different network, and they banned that person. So now you get less reach because one of the people who is retweeting you to other influential people has been wiped off the system. And this is something that's really interesting because, you know, relatively speaking, I don't really have, in terms of number of followers, I don't have a huge number of followers. But it's really intriguing to me is because, you know, depending, not just where, you know, not just in pure numbers, but in terms of like across all social media stuff and people that actually, you know, listen to my stuff, they're overwhelmingly, I have really interesting how I think it's disproportionately influential the people I have. Like, and it's weird because like again, the Larry Correa thing you brought up, you know, it's like, I have people, like, I'll say stuff and I'll see something I said out in the wild, someone else is repeating what I said, and then later, you know, someone who does have a big following. And, you know, there's people that I'm, and those are usually people that I'm a mutual follow with, or they'll later privately acknowledge that they got the idea from me, which is pretty cool. And that's one of the things. It's like, you know, raw numbers is one thing, but another thing too is like, you know, there's something, it's really interesting, is something called a Cat's Prestige, which is basically network fitness. It's like, it's not just how many followers and network connections you have as an individual. It's how many people your followers are connected to as well, like how big their following is. So you can have a relatively small number of followers or direct connections, but if the people that you're connected to are extremely influential in their own right and have big followings, then you have a big high Cat's Prestige number, which is, and it's really one of those intuitive things you think of, you know, like it's not immediately apparent, but as soon as you start to think about it, that makes a lot of sense. Cause if you've got a small network of people that are highly influential, then, you know, you can actually make a lot more influence than you might think. But no, that's the sort of thing that you see, like Facebook has something called, targeted network disruption. And they did this stuff against like the Boogaloo Boys and stuff. Like they will actually analyze networks of people that are communicating and are friends together and then wipe out an entire network of people. They did this to the Proud Boys. They did this to all kinds of other people. And that's one of the important things is like, even if there's big right-wing accounts that are left, a lot of the things you see on these social media sites is they will target and eliminate like a mid-level network. People that aren't like the A-list people, but they're people that provide like a mesh network in the middle that really transmit these ideas into different network node areas.
One of the best applications I've seen on the right of this idea, it happens in very small small section, but it's actually handled in an entertaining enough way. I suggest your readers go ahead and reread What I Saw at the Coup, because specifically in story of What I Saw at the Coup, which is, you know, it's a right-wing fantasy, but nonetheless, what it features is, they say that essentially, there was an attempted coup, essentially, and then essentially the left is counter-couped, and then they're executed and all this, but what happens is, there's a news blackout, and this is done by, essentially, rewritten Obama administration, right? It's a right-wing fever dream of Obama administration going full mask-off death squads. But what they do is, instead of rolling up the top A-listers, instead of rolling up Alex Jones, instead of rolling up Dan Bongino, instead of rolling up these people, right? Instead of rolling up Len Beck or rolling up Tucker Carlson, they roll up the people a level below. And it actually goes into this little analysis, right? And it says about pre-dawn raids, coordinated kidnapping, essentially executions, essentially a Chilean style, or you know, Night of Long Knives, whatever you wish to call it, but the coordinated killing and assassination of people the network. But it says specifically they choose people not at the top of the network, but the mid-level network nodes, specifically just for that, to disrupt the ability of the networks to be effective, and to degrade network effectiveness, without saying that these A-list people that it would actually galvanize, and proving that this person has disappeared would actually be enough to galvanize action, instead attack lower-level nodes, so that people can't necessarily know that this happened, and so they never fully are reach a point that says, okay, it started, 1776 happens again. You know, again, there's an idea that is not entirely wrong, that the safest way to be safe, you know, if you're going against a government or a big organization, is to be so big, to be so powerful, and to be so notorious, that if any action was taken against you, it would be seen as enemy action, and that your supporters, essentially, would take it as a green light to do things they would not do legally.
Go ahead.
Just very simply. However, if instead of taking that person out, you take out the five people that make them, you take out the five people that are responsible for another 50% of their network growth, you never fully reach that, but you instead have the effects of that their network has, and you have it again for other influencers and all this, and suddenly consensus has a much harder ability to gather.
Yeah, that reminds me, what was the name? I can't believe I'm drawing a blank here now. It's like right on the tip of my tongue. The family that Machiavelli, in the Medicis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Medicis.
Wow.
It was really interesting because someone did a network analysis of them, and it wasn't that they had the most connections, or they were even the most wealthiest or most influential family. It's when you did a social graph of all the prominent families, in Italy at the time, but especially in Italy, when you graphed them all out, the Medici family was
probably Florence.
Yeah, it was Florence, but no, they were in between, but basically all of the influential families like on the peninsula really. When you graphed out the major players, the Medici family was in the middle of all of them. All of the connections from all the major players went through the Medici. So even though the Medici themselves, you know, they weren't the most influential players, they didn't have like the biggest network graph themselves, but they were the central node that kind of everyone went through. So they had a lot more influence than you would think if you just tried to say, hey, they got, because you know, in terms of social media, the Medicis didn't have the most followers. They just had the biggest players. And they were critical for those biggest players to actually, until they became the biggest players, because they were the one, they were the critical node. Anyway, that's nerdery there.
It's nerdery, but it's an important point. And the important point is this. Things don't necessarily operate linearly, right? They don't necessarily, it's not necessarily the person who's number one on the Forbes list who's actually got the most liquid wealth, okay? Like, you know, a perfect example. You want to say you're the richest man in the world. You can use multiple ways to calculate this. But ultimately, like, you know, Elon Musk to buy Twitter. He had to put up stock as things, and it wasn't liquid.
Italy didn't exist.
Correct.
At that time, but yes. I was thinking the peninsula. Of course, Italy was like 1870 and like the Duke of Savoy. So again, I was saying all the families in Italy, but it was like, of course, Italy was non-existent. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
This is why I specified Florence.
I was like,
this is why I
it took me. Thank you, because I had a brain fart and couldn't think Medici. Yes. I was like,
regardless, anyway. I'm not here to cancel you. I'm not here to cancel you off of
part of the free flowing stuff. Is like my brain when you have an idea and like you know who you're talking about, but you can't. You're like, because again, we're like a lot of this stuff we're free flowing. Okay, so I'm
but
like,
perfect.
Ah, go ahead.
Perfect example, right? Uh-huh. Is what Twitter would do in this circumstance. Is you say that, oh well, the Medicis are connected to Italy. I would say, really? I disagree, and you know, I don't think we can have relevant discussion about this. And essentially, I pedantically, and this is the perfect word for it, pedantic, or I pretend to be dumb, or I pretend to not understand that the context is referring to the many nation states of Italy at time, that she's referring to the Florence and to the major banking trading families and all this, to play dumb essentially, to not essentially use my human cultural thing to bridge the gap. I understood what point Aaron was trying to make, in that yes, it was an outmoded, it was a concept that had not come yet. Garibaldi had not come and not united Italy. In fact, you know, even going back to Dante, who, you know, many, many years before had wanted to unite Italy. It had been a project for nearly 1,000 years, perhaps longer, to reunite Italy. But point is, I went with it, and I understood, in good faith, I understood what you were talking about. I filled in blank for you, I said Florence, and I moved on to have good faith discussion. What Twitter would do is they'd say, someone would say, are you shadow banning me? Or, you know, be asked, you know, do you engage in shadow banning? And Twitter would say, no, we don't engage in shadow banning. Or are we using shadow banning in extreme circumstances, but we don't use it very often, that's all. It does not happen. Any of the accounts you name me accounts, I'll tell you if they're shadow banned or not, they would not do it. But again, that's like the thing. That's the equivalent of saying, "Oh, well, you know, if they were most, you know, if they were most connected to Italy, then that doesn't explain how they did things." It would be like me essentially pretending not to know that Aaron was referring to a family that existed hundreds of years before what is Italy now, and proceeding from that kind of thing. It's essentially bad faith. It's pedantic, and so essentially, you know, if I proceeded to play dumb, or I proceeded to say, yes, I bet, you know, if they had connections to Italy, then I guess they had more connections than anyone at the time. So I would completely agree with you, because no one could have had connections. This is what Twitter staff would do. What good faith is to say, I think you meant Florence, I think you mean these things, and let me clarify the difference between Florence and the nation states of what eventually became Italy. Let us clarify this and have discussion here. This is what good faith looks like. Twitter would not engage into good faith. They would say, yes, not shadow banning. By the particular definition of shadow banning, depending on what the definition of is, which I've specified down in user term page 567 under this subparagraph, and it's covered here in sort of wishy-washy language that isn't said, no, we don't engage in Italy. We don't engage in network disruption in Italy, because we're only engaging in network disruption in Florence. And this is what happened with the Twitter thing.
Yeah, no, if someone started talking to you like that, or started engaging on in that terms of like, no, I don't think, you know, this very, like, well, actually type of attitude, like, in real life, like, when someone does that well, actually bullshit, we all know it's like, it's like you just get up and walk out because the person is, like, deliberately trying to provoke you, or they're just being obstructive. They're not trying to have an honest conversation. Yeah, I was thinking like it was weird. I was getting all mangled up there because I was like, I've been like forgetting names all night. But no, it was like I guess I was thinking Merchant of Venice. So I was like, no, Venice isn't right. But I was thinking Merchant of Venice was stuck in my head. But anyway, no. But thank you for helping, because that was a tangent and I didn't have enough time. Because the thing is, like, it takes me a little bit to download the information in my head where I've got to like straighten it out and then say it. So when I'm trying to do it on the fly, I'm like in the process of trying to remember what I'm saying. Go ahead.
What if you saying? Have, I have a couple more points I did want mm-hmm. to hit. Actually,
hit it. Yeah.
So very simply, you know, the last two parts of the ban of Donald Trump are also, I think, illustrative too. Right. Mm-hmm. It establishes essentially animus against Donald Trump, but it also establishes very simply, and this is the thing, right? The right wants a simple, oh, we conspired to ban him, even though he didn't deserve it, and he was totally innocent, and there was thing, and like, you know, and we're evil people, mwahaha, looking for the Ernst Stavro Blofeld, looking for the Joseph Stalin, for the you know, for the leader of Germany in the 1930s. I'm doing this so you don't get cut to call us, you know, the followers of the 1930s German leader. Point is this: Donald Trump was banned, And so you're not going to find a smoking gun saying, yes, he, you know, they said that, yes, there's under no terms that he couldn't be banned. But you see that they actually do believe that he is a threat. And they actually do believe he's a thing. But here's the more important thing. And this is something actually, to his credit, that Tim Pool said years ago was problem with the way Twitter saw things. They essentially see that Donald Trump is a threat to current order. And they see that, that essentially any tweet he sends out, essentially, is the argument that they ultimately ended up settling on, is that people were so radicalized and so angry. And any tweet by Donald Trump that did not that was not conceding election was essentially calls to violence. They saw it as incitement. Again, in the Twitter files number 4 and number 5, you will see they say no, it's not actual calls to violence. No, it's not coded calls to violence. It's none of these things, and so we can't ban him. But ultimately, what they end up settling on is essentially, well, if anything Trump says, if it isn't a complete concession, go home and do your things, will be seen as call to violence, and so this is enough for us to ban him. And that's his point. It is consequentialist. It's very much what is outcome, and Twitter's trying to avoid it, trying to do these things. But ultimately, when there isn't a consensus, the only consensus is what happens. And the consensus has to pre-exist. You can't create the consensus. You can't create the homogeneity of vision. And so the thing is, these people truly did see anything Donald Trump did as violence to system. And so this is a perfect example. They don't see that you can have any rational debate that would actually delegitimize or have a chance of winning against the other side. The very nature of Donald Trump winning, the very nature of people perhaps rebelling and doing these kinds of things. The thing is, you know, and I think Michael Anton's touched upon it to his credit as well. Very simply, these people don't really have an answer for why 1776 in America was a valid maneuver. Basically, their thing is, well, it was valid because it's old, but there's no conditions, you know, and this is I believe, Michael Anton's test today. Does anyone believe that there is another condition or that you can essentially have 1776 become a valid legal or justified thing today? And essentially, they don't. And essentially, they believe that any attempt to sweep things back, or not even to go with 1776, they would argue, essentially, that any attempt to roll back rights for people, say an anti-Roe v. Wade thing, and, you know, because that's already done and settled. Essentially, what you see here is any attempt to roll back Roe v. Wade in just simple organizing, simple doing these kinds of things. No bigotry, just people working towards these things. The end itself is violence. The end itself is a problem because it takes away rights from people. And so attempts to shadow ban or to disrupt these groups are in themselves valid because ultimately they're starting from a reality where the consensus or the end is already decided upon. It is not the way you see things or the way you've decided upon things. And so things can be justified for that.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where we talk about, you know, the importance of network and community and a lot of the things, you know, a lot of these bannings and disruptions, they're about destroying organic community. Because organic community, you know, part of the whole thing is, you know, individual freedom and rights are important, but at the same time, you don't want to become atomized. Because then, you know, if you're alone, people that are alone have rarely been able to change things themselves just because you need a network of people, you need a community of people. And that's what gives people the courage to really act. You know, one of the things to kind of get back closer to the actual Twitter files themselves, a couple of the things that really are interesting to me about it is, again, we've touched on, you know, they're kind of in their own little echo chamber. And like this is the PMC mindset. And it's one of those things where it's very dangerous to dissent from that if you're someone in that white collar urbanoid type job, because you don't want to lose your status, you don't want to lose your access to good jobs because that person's you know, heck, even if you're just like a moderate person like the Weinsteins or something, you know, they're the guys from the Evergreen College, you know, they're very moderate, but still they're considered like alt-right racists because, you know, they're like, hey, some of this shit is crazy, you know, we probably should rethink this sort of stuff. One of the interesting, you know, we've talked about the network stuff where it's like there's such a revolving door between a lot of the political, you know, senior executive service people and the Democratic Party and these tech company white collar middle class type people. So it shouldn't be surprising that, you know, again, that's one thing they mentioned in there is the Democrats called more than the Republicans to try to get people banned from the internet or from Twitter. But part of that was because the Democrats simply had more connection to the company themselves.
Nah.
And I've actually done that myself. I mean, I haven't called to have people banned, but in terms of, you know, being able to call these companies, because again, a lot of these folks, you can't just call the company themselves and have something change. You've got to, there's no way to directly contact them. So you've got to know someone on the inside. And I've had that before with like bans and warnings and stuff that I've gotten. It's like I happen to know a few people at different companies, and I've been able to call them on the phone or text them and be like, hey, this happened. And like, oh, wow, that's clearly bullshit. Let me see if I can fix that. And, you know, they've been able to do some stuff to help me out in some cases, and sometimes they haven't been able to. It just really depends, you know. But I had that opportunity because I just knew people. I knew some people. And there's actually some folks that have a business of literally contact. Like there's middlemen, people who have a business where they're like, hey, you know, if you want to be one of my clients, I can contact these companies and get your bans lifted if it's bullshit. And they do this for a lot of, like, they don't really do this for individuals unless they're like major influencers, but they do this with a lot of a lot of brands and stuff. So that's a big thing there, and that's part of the network stuff that we're talking about. And I think one of the things I want to touch on here is, you know, we started talking about the First Amendment stuff, and I think this is sort of interesting. But before I jump into that, you wanted to add something, so I'll let you do that.
Yeah, I think really simply, Twitter is actually a better way to understand the left than people understand. You know, as a company, it's perhaps one of the best ways to understand it. The blue check marks, why, right? They're handed out because of notability. So what is notability? The blue check mark indicates notability, but is it, 10,000 people come to Times Square, shout your name out at 12 p.m. On a Sunday or something like that? No, you could go on Fiverr, buy people to do that. Is it appearing on the New York Times? Maybe that contributes, but there's no objective standard, right, to achieve this kind of thing under the old standards. So Elon Musk is attempting to make objective standards. You pay $8. Great, $8. But this also gets away from the notability aspect that people relied on Twitter for. So this is the problem. People don't want to actually grapple with the idea of what notability is. And frankly, you know, it's Curtis Yarvin in Grey Mirror actually said, dealt with this, albeit in a way that it makes Reich very unhappy. And he says that Elon Musk should not be trying to expand the number of blue badges. In fact, he should be limiting it, and in fact, he should charge, not $8, but something like $80,000, $800,000, something like that. He said he should charge an exorbitant amount, so that essentially, if you can pay for it, it means you're notable, and so it becomes a mark of distinction, as it were. And it goes in a very angry direction. But really, like I said, all this is to indicate, right, that the right finally understands that they are losing influence, they are losing war, they are losing influence, and that they wish to push back, they wish to be able to get blue checks, they wish to get levers of power without necessarily fully understanding what's happening. They understand that they are not winning, they understand that the current mechanisms are biased against them and they lose. And it doesn't matter if you say that it wasn't because of shadow banning, because instead it was of de-boosting, because of de-amplification, because of search banning, because of search shadow boxing, whatever. They understand you're changing the rules, you're disadvantaging them, and fuck you. And this is actually, like I said, this is actually an important thing, and the important thing to take away from Twitter files is not specifics, is to understand the way conspiracies work. They'll work right out in the open. They'll say the terms to you. You won't understand what's being said. They'll misinterpret. They'll use that to actually launch 50 different interpretations that are all privately held. And then they'll say, well, we already told you, so we didn't lie, and if we lied anyways, it's a good thing. And you shouldn't win anyways. The point is this, quite simply. They said that essentially that people engaging in January 6th were illegitimate. The very activity of these kinds of protests were illegitimate, and anything that stops those things, anything that disrupts those things, anything that stops that from happening is itself illegitimate. And that we are quickly coming to a point where right is finally beginning to understand any effective action that they may take is by definition of the left illegitimate, which quickly starts to foreclose. I think in the discourse they talk about the four boxes. You have to create political change. That being the soapbox to yell at people about what you believe things should be and how you should change things. The ballot box, that being which you can sort of vote to change things and all this. The moving box, so you can move the idea between the democracy of the states. You can move to a state that's more to your liking. And finally, there's the last box. People refer to it by many different names. But it holds, shall we say, brass and powder that makes rapid combustion with lead encased with copper.
Yes, it's the box of it truly is Pandora's box in so
truly
many ways.
Pandora's box, truly voting from rooftops as they did it. And quickly quite simply, the right is finally beginning to understand.
You quickly quite simply? No, I'm just
quite simply they are beginning to understand the other three boxes are in fact foreclosed in many ways. People are starting to doubt the voting box, or it's very much doubting voting boxes, as you saw, with people tearing up ballots and leaving ballot box. Well, they're starting to believe that isn't working for them. They are seeing that their speech and that the ways of their speech is being regulated is being taken from them as well. And, if you want to talk about the moving box, people aren't moving in all this. But, again, depending on federal regulations and how people see if they can move to do things, people may still see moving boxes thing. Question is, do people see that as sufficient or enough? So, quite as I said, I think people are beginning to rapidly start to coalesce upon final box. And this is what is interesting, and understanding that that final box really only makes sense if it actually is a viable alternative and the other side believes it viable alternative that you may use.
Yeah, there's a lot there I want to respond to on several different things you raised. You know, it's interesting, the notability part of the blue check, because it was, it turned out later that they would turn people down when you applied for a blue check, and then someone from the verification team would reach out to the person that was turned down and say, hey, we can get you a blue check. It's going to cost you $15,000. And people would fucking pay that. Like, that's shit that was happening. And this is sort of interesting, too, because, you know, like, I ran across a kid. Like, there was a 19-year-old student reporter for some college newspaper, for literally a student paper at his university. He had, like, 400 followers, and he had a blue check. This is before the Twitter blue verification. And I was like, how the fuck did he get that? And that's really one of the things that happened. It's like, you had to be truly notable, like a truly notable person, or you had to be any form of journalist. Like, you could send in, like, something from a letterhead. It was one of those things where if you worked in any capacity in the news, that just pretty much pro forma, they would send a list to verification at Twitter to verify these accounts, because these people are working with us with the news. So, you know, they were just handing those things out. The kid, it was a 19-year-old kid at a student-run newspaper at a university, and, you know, he had a blue check with, like, 400 followers. But, yeah, other than that, you know, it was very opaque, and it's one of the interesting things about it. You know, we talk about, you know, conspiracy, and that's another place where I think you're seeing the damage of atomization and the destruction of organic communities to the right, because the right doesn't have a real mental model for what conspiracy looks like. Yes. And I don't want to dive off into that, but I do want to do a separate podcast of just about conspiracy and what it really is and what it means, because, again, it's one of those things where it's not conspiracy, it's culture. Everyone just sort of knows what needs to be done, and they do it without even really having to be told. You know, again, that's kind of that's what you see in the Twitter files. It's really interesting because there's people that are talking, but there's also everyone else that they're working with. They all kind of have this unspoken understanding because they're all part of the same social milieu and they have a lot of the same values. So you don't have to explicitly tell someone. Like, it's one of the things in there, someone says that, you know, they view Donald Trump as on par with the Christchurch shooter or like Adolf Hitler. And he's a leader of a terror. Like, they literally explicitly said that. that Donald Trump was the leader of a violent terrorist organization. And like, at what point, like, if you really think that, if that is something you honestly think, then how can you engage in the political process with these people? Because even if these people, because if you really, if you think that, even if the other team wins a legitimate election, you're not going to respect it.
Duh.
So at that point, it's just an open admission that, you know, any form of political, you know, problem solving is over.
Duh. Well, I think Twitter files number 5, Barry Weiss. I disagree with Barry Weiss significantly on many issues, but I will give credit where due. I am honest broker. So specifically in Twitter files number 5, what she does, and I think this is really what the reporting needs. She says, to understand Twitter's decision to ban Trump, we must consider how Twitter deals with other heads of state and political leaders, including in Iran, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. Number 20. In June 2018, Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei tweeted, "Is hashtag Israel is a this is this again these are the words of Khamenei." These are the words of Khamenei. Malignant cancerous tumor, these are the words of Khamenei, in the West Asian region that has to be removed and eradicated. It is possible and it will happen. Twitter neither deleted the tweet nor banned the Ayatollah. So this is still standing, right? Now, and again, she has personal issues on it, personal feelings on this one. Tweet number 21. In October 2020, the former Malaysian Prime Minister said it was said, quote, "It was right. It was, quote, a right," unquote. For Muslims to, quote, from Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, to kill millions of French people, unquote. Twitter deleted his tweet for glorifying violence, but it remains on the platform. The tweet below was taken from the Wayback Machine, and she links to it. And so she goes through, basically, notable people or world leaders actually tweeting out calls to violence, tweeting out violence and all this, and then not being banned. And so it puts in context that this treatment of Trump and being singled out was, in fact, very different and not in keeping with things. But that's the thing. There is no rules, but also the argument would be, well, Donald Trump presents a unique threat. And, he presents a unique threat. You must treat U.S. president as different in all this. And, again, this is funny. If you're a U.S. patriot, do you believe America is the same as other countries? Do you believe we are a unique country that is uniquely different and bigger and better than other countries? You're forced into this space to say, well, no, we're not any different. We're not any different, any stronger, any more powerful, any better than other countries. Or you say, yes, we are, but it's different. And again, you sort of lost the debate, and this is the sort of space you get forced into by the way they look at the world, as opposed to saying if there's not objective set of standards, if there's not objective set of standards, that is made ahead, and then maybe that is the most depoliticized solution. But ultimately, yes, it's about deciding upon this, and they don't wish to have impact. Again, the thing is, if there was actual coordination to sort of say to roll back Obergefell, to roll back gay marriage. They would see this as a threat to protected people, to LGBT peoples, to have a right to marry as a, to have the right to marry, and this and any attempt to do this would be a attempt to restrict their civil rights. And so this itself, no matter how legal, no matter how above board, no calls to violence, no kind of things, this itself, this political action, would itself be banned because of terms of service. And so this is the thing. Ultimately, if what you want is actually different and in fact conflicts with the way other people see things, you are not allowed to win, and they will not allow you to win, and they will make many other words to say it. But ultimately, like I said, that's the ultimate telling question. You ask a leftist, okay, under what terms could I do this? Under what terms could I do this? Take something that you may not even support. Ask them, under what terms, if we abolish the 19th Amendment, the right for women to vote, would you abide by it? Or, what legal process would it be right to remove the right of women to vote? They'd say, well, it's not, it's illegitimate on its face. This is the thing. They're illegitimacies, right? They will not allow particular rights or particular things to happen. The fact it happened is signs it is illegitimate itself. And that is ultimately something that you have to come to terms with.
That's I think that's an excellent point. And it's not that what the person said was not something really they were it wasn't that it was a novel thought. It's like that specific statement that the person said was simply them expressing kind of the implicit cultural position for everyone that worked there. Like, that was what they already sort of thought and said amongst themselves. Even the Joel Roth guy, like, he said that, like, you know, he was flipping out in 2017 about Nazis in the White House. You know, if he thought that in 2017...
And publicly tweeted it,
you know, there's a except there's essentially no difference between what he said and the statement between the other group that, hey, he's the leader of a terrorist group on par with Adolf Hitler. There's essentially, like, that tweet there was just, you know, it was pretty, like, eyebrow-raising, but it wasn't anything, you know, it was just the unspoken position of everyone else that you see in that chat is what they already thought. You know, they just weren't yet in a position where they're really willing to actually make a public statement to the world that... But you've got the people internally already saying that, and they're just saying what they already think. That's what the people in the Bay largely overwhelmingly already think. That's what a lot of these management class people, the PMC class people, already think. And they think that about all the flyover people, you know, all the flyover red state Americans. That's what they think, and that's really sort of, that's a prelude to, like, eliminationist, like, that's... I would consider that eliminationist rhetoric off the bat, because you're just saying these people are not legitimate. We don't have to listen to anything they have to say. They're explicitly saying that these people are they're a terror. 75 million Americans are a terrorist group.
And again, you have to understand, they see, if they actually see this way, they see themselves as actually better than the right. Why? Because instead of actually eliminating them, what they're going to do is they're going to find a way to peacefully, NPR voice, engage in electoral and democratic reforms to allow them to peacefully live their lives and to allow everyone else to peacefully live their lives, but to reduce their impact and to make sure that their actions, that their terrorist actions do not impact others, and to slowly wind them down. I don't wish to refer to the 1930s leader and all this, but at some point I think I have to. Very simply, the Wannsee Conference, the Wannsee Conference, which is really the only really solid evidence of top level leadership discussing what to do about the about Jewish people in Europe. The Wannsee Conference decides, essentially, that most of them need to be, quote-unquote, evacuated. They, of course, use the term evacuated in a different term. It does not mean evacuation. It means what happens. But they say that for the truly stellar people that actually contributed to these kinds of things, they will need to be sterilized, and they can peacefully live their lives out, but they need to be sterilized to remove their ability to reproduce. And so, essentially, the left see, if they see you as terrorists, right? They actually see themselves as more humane and better than them. Because instead of evacuating, which means eliminating these people, by finding ways to limit their impact or to essentially sterilize both, not literally, but to sterilize the impact and to slowly start to replace, to do these kinds of things and all this, it's a peaceful way of reducing impact. It's de-amplifying impact of these violent, dangerous, terrible people, and this is by this harm reduction view, sort of this effective altruist view. They actually are creating the greatest possible good for the greatest number of people, because they're not causing harm to people, and they're also reducing the harm created by those harmful people.
Yeah, it's a lot of. Is it on par with that? No, but it's like one of this. It's very similar, like the logic that they used in terms of, you know, people will justify. People are capable of justifying absolutely anything to themselves, you know, given the right motivations for that. I think one of the things, there's a lot of stuff here. Now, one of the other things, you know, this is really interesting. I want to talk more about, like, conspiracy and what it actually looks like. And I feel like we won't actually talk about it now. I want to do it on a separate one. I want to start wrapping this one up here. But, you know, I do want to talk on another podcast about what, you know, because the right people on the right, you know, I just feel like they're so atomized and there's no organic culture community anymore. So they have a hard time picturing, like, what does a conspiracy look like? No. Like, how do you get a large group of people to work together towards some sort of thing? And, you know, this is why so many people lean towards the conspiracy idea of, you know, a lot of people are planning in a boardroom when you don't really have to do that, which is not how, that's not really how these people are often doing that. It's just a lot of people who share the same ideology, like ideology in a way, well, not even in a way, it just does, like a certain ideological, like a worldview and an ideology partially solves the coordination problem because everyone kind of knows what needs to be done. So a lot of these people are able and willing to work independently towards it.
And if you're working with someone intelligent, someone that accomplishes things, and specifically accomplishes them through a similar background, right? So you accomplish, say you come from a finance background, right? And you understand things, okay. Well, the way we solve budget shortfalls, as it were, right, is we take a look at the balance sheets, we look at them again, we rectify things, we justify, we look at every expense, we make sure that there's no dime unaccounted for, and we make sure that they actually are what they say they are. We make sure that office expenses are office expenses, that they aren't actually someone going and spending $60,000 on a Vegas trip with below, okay? So you did that. Well, okay, now we have very simple, and so we start to look at expenses, we start to look at the revenue brought in by expenses, or profit brought in, and you know, it depends on which one you're trying to maximize for, and then you say, okay, so we're going to find which divisions are least productive as far as it goes, and we're going to start to trim those fat, and then we're going to look for the employees that bring the least revenue, and so you do this analysis, right, and so then you just simply by this, sort of put on the actuary glasses, you start eliminating these accountant, green shade or whatever, you start doing this. When people do that, then you don't need to say, like, you know, the company has problems, or we have problems, we need to tighten our belts, as it were. People with that similar background all know that the way you do is you start to scrutinize expenses. And so you don't need to say, well, scrutinize the expenses, I'll cut the food budget at Twitter. No, it's known that the look, they'll say, well, look at the food budget at Twitter, look at how few people are eating it, look at how much food is thrown out or whatever. You say that, you know, we feed on average 15 people a day, call it 365 days a year. So we're feeding under, you know, we are serving 80,000 meals, but only whatever, 6,000 meals are consumed. That means there's a deadweight loss, essentially, of 74,000 meals. 74,000 meals are going in the trash. Let's just eliminate that and make people pay for it, and so it's not doing that kind of thing, and that suddenly eliminates expenses immediately, right? Like, you don't need to say, eliminate the food budget. People will do that because they come from the background, and they know that the people effectively down there will do that. You don't need to say it because background says the people will find these things, and you don't need to coordinate it. And so there won't be a smoking gun that, oh, they canceled the food budget at Twitter because they specifically did it. Oh, evil. I mean, Elon Musk is doing this in part because this is how right understands things. Everything should be debated, everything should be open, everything should be done that way. The left is far more implicit. Everything is about implicitness. The art on the right, you know, Donald Trump appealed to the right because what he would do is, you know, Donald Trump would, you know, the height of class to sort of, you know, and this is not true of all people on the right, but this is the Donald Trump right, as it were. The Donald Trump right would say the height of class, essentially, is that, people would be eating their meal, and then Donald Trump would walk in, he'd sit down and eat his meal, and then in the middle of the meal, when the first group stands up to get the waiter to pay their bill, Donald Trump would stand up and say, "Everyone, I'm paying for your meal, like, you know, I have paid for it because I'm great, because I'm Donald Trump, everyone's meal's on me, all drinks are on me, I'm the greatest, Donald Trump 2024. This is the Donald Trump kind of thing, right? What the left would see is better. Is instead, the quiet, you know, eponymous, called Obama but a billionaire, right? Called this type. He would quietly walk in with entourage, no one would really notice him, a few people that know things would take very surreptitious selfies and all this kind of stuff. He'd deal with it, he'd quietly go in, he'd do the things, he'd call a waiter over, he'd say, you know, everyone pay the bill, let them pay their bills, but then backcharge the accounts and all this so that the credit card refunds the money back to them, so they think they paid the bill, but the bill will go to me, they'll walk out thinking they paid the bill, thinking nothing happened, but they'll cover the bill for them. And when they come back to the restaurant, they can find out what happened. That is much more the left way of doing things. It's much more, I'm used to, from, again, a more leftist background, perhaps people reaching for a bill at end of dinner. Reaching to take and pay entire bill, not to split bill. It's a different social milieu. And it's a different way of operating. And the right doesn't understand it, but they are finally starting to understand the downstream effects of it.
Well, I think one of the things, one of the biggest, like, illustrations of what's actually happening, in my opinion, is, you know, you can just watch, like, you know, again, the left projects so much, and you can see a lot of what they actually do and what they accuse other people doing. Like, the whole stochastic terrorism thing that they talk about if you criticize someone, you're actually just, you know, targeting them for terrorism by being attacked by random lone actors. That's one of the things that the left has got a real hard on for here lately, is anyone, if you ever criticize anyone on the left, you know, they don't say the left, but, you know, if you're criticizing us, it's because you want us to be attacked. Well, that's what they actually do. It's like everyone kind of knows that. If someone gets, you know, if you're criticized by the media or especially some of these Antifa researcher people, that the whole point of that is putting a target on you so that everyone else that knows the script can start running it against you. And yeah, that's what it really is. Again, I want to do like a whole separate podcast on just conspiracy stuff. But one of the things, you know, starting to kind of wrap it up, I usually try to keep them under an hour now because it's nice and digestible. What I think here with this, the last thing I want to say is I think what's really interesting here, I don't know if we're quite there yet with it, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not super comfortable making pronouncements. But, you know, there's a lot of talk about something called the state actor doctrine, which is pretty interesting. It's basically, you know, again, people have been talking for a while now about the media, you know, about tech companies being cutouts for the government to kind of ban people that the government can't do themselves because there's the First Amendment. Now, there's something called state actor doctrine, which is basically, and it's fairly interesting, and, you know, I don't know if we're quite there yet. I think we're a lot closer to that than we would have before. But basically the idea is, you know, if the government influences a private business to silence someone, and it doesn't even have to be explicitly, it can be implicit. Like a lot of these companies, like Twitter is under an FTC consent decree for like the past decade. And I think what's really interesting was, and this is the part about it's not about the files themselves, although that is hinted at in the files. There's lots of government back and forth. You know, they're always in contact with government agents. Part of that's one of the clues that I really see about that is the amount of communication they have and you know, messages from members of government that are like, hey, can you take this thing down for me? Well, you know, another part of that, too, is the reaction that we've seen ever since the Twitter files dropped. Because there's been a lot of people that are just like, you know, FTC, like the FTC, like when they share, what, like the Twitter file drop that you liked was the number two. And part of that was it included screenshots of the Twitter internal dashboard where they can actually, you know, go in there and access a person's account and actually, you know, it shows what sort of flags are placed on the account. Well, they were getting threatened with like FTC violations for merely showing what their internal dashboard looks like that are applied against individuals, like how you can deboost someone, how you can search ban them. They were getting threats for that, for just merely saying, hey, this is how the company in the past has banned people or how they have suppressed their reach, and this is what it looks like. And you've got, you know, I think like, you know, Adam Schiff was like talking about, you need to go out and like, there's hate speech on the internet. There's hate speech on Twitter. You know, Elon Musk, you need to do something to suppress this or we're going to do it for you. He made some statement like that. So there's a lot of statements, I think, which, you know, again, not a lawyer, don't want to make a pronouncement on this sort of stuff, but it looks like they're starting to really point towards being able to make that state actor argument. And I think that would really help Elon Musk out. And I think that was actually something that a lot of these tech companies, like Jack Dorsey had that response where he wrote something talking about where the internet needs to go, a decentralized moderate. It's not moderation, but it's like you can more directly access your algorithm for what you want to see. And it's more of the person themselves gets to moderate it. But it's really interesting to me is because I think that Elon Musk is probably giving, because right now there is a lawsuit from the Attorney General Eric Schmidt of Missouri and the AG of Louisiana and a couple other people, and they're suing a bunch of tech companies talking about First Amendment violations because of the influence from the government pressuring these people. That's part of the argument. And I think Elon Musk is giving them ammunition for that lawsuit. And I think that's something that Elon Musk would like, because if these companies, I think a lot of these companies would like that. They're like, hey, we can't moderate because the Supreme Court has just ruled because of government interference and oversight. The FTC consent decrees that we have to comply with and all these other things that because of the pressure the government has influenced on us, you know, we are now subject to the First Amendment as state actors. I think they would like that because it would take it out of their hands. They're like, hey, don't blame me, just blame the Supreme Court.
Right, it's really interesting. Years ago, and I promise not to make this too long digression, years ago there was big to-do over Section 230, and this was about, I promise this is relevant, I'm not going to go too deep onto this. Basically, it's about that government has no right to regulate sites as long as they don't show editorial control over internet sites. And the idea was, basically, Craigslist, you know, has people that are, you know, trying to traffic children, and this is illegal, but as long as they aren't editorializing and promoting the stuff, essentially they couldn't be held responsible for children being trafficked. This is the principle, basically. The problem is, with social media, this came much after Section 230, algorithms are choices. They're making choices for people. Algorithms are the choices. It is essentially editorialization. But it's not editorialization as far as the law goes. Thing is, these kinds of editorial choices are being made, and they're being made, but they're not being made to choose things for people. But they aren't, you know, getting pushback, and they aren't getting their regulation. So, of course, what happens is you have interested people that get in places to impact the editorial choices, to impact people, to impact these decisions, but it's not overseen by that kind of stuff. And this is ultimately where, again, the sort of libertarian kind of thing fails, because ultimately, you know, the failure of libertarianism essentially is in the, in my view, it's in the, the housing covenant thing, the thing. What do you call the housing thing that you joined? HOAs.
HOAs, yeah.
Yeah, the HOAs. Essentially, an HOA is a perfectly libertarian kind of thing. You can do whatever you want, but you can create different rules that fit by an HOA. But the libertarians never end up controlling HOAs because they're not interested in that kind of governance. What happens is busybodies who want to do anti-libertarian things end up taking over. So essentially, the most libertarian kind of form of governance never works for libertarians because they're not interested in governance. And so the thing is, you ultimately have to essentially reach someone that's willing to govern in a way that is most efficacious or most in line with the way you want to govern, because there will be governance, there will not be anarchy. And again, maybe the anarchists will debate this, but this is the libertarian problem. They haven't gone full anarchist, because they still believe that it's essentially a libertarian anarchic balance will happen on its own when it won't. And that's essentially the thing. Ultimately, Section 230 maybe was relevant at the time, but essentially it's been left behind by algorithms and all this. And essentially, you have choices to not have algorithms in all these places, but they suck. Not having algorithms sucks. You do want an algorithm. It makes your life easier and better instead of having to manually weed through things. So you do want an algorithm. You just want it to work the way you want it to work. And that is, I think, crux of the problem.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think Section 230... was definitely a positive thing for the internet. I still think that it is worthwhile, net positive. I think it is one of those things where it's really interesting because it's only like 27 words or something. But it is, it gives you immunity. It gives the internet service provider immunity for things that are posted, as long as they do not solicit the content. This is why, like, website like Gawker got destroyed in a lawsuit because they solicited the content about Hulk Hogan. So that's how you can still be, like, if someone else, if a third party posts it and you don't solicit the content, then you're in the clear. But if, like, you actually pay someone to post a story and it's libelous or in some other way illegal, then you can be held responsible for it. I think the thing, anyway, I think that's where we're going with that. It'd be really interesting to see, because it's a lawsuit, and I feel like Elon is dumping ammunition for this lawsuit that is currently working its way through the courts. Because I think that would be something that a lot of these companies would appreciate. Because it's such a headache. Because you're in a point where centralized moderation becomes a weapon at this scale, and that's a weapon everyone's going to try to grasp. And if you keep, if you keep building that, then the other side's going to eventually take power and use it too, because that's really what that's what Section 230 was originally about. A lot of the Republicans wanted that back in the 90s because they wanted to ban porn from the internet. And it ended up now you've got that, and now they're trying to ban, hate speech, which is anyone that's, not turbo commie or turbo leftist progressive anarcho communism nonsense. And now we're seeing it the other way. And I think a lot of these people, that especially the guys who have been on the internet forever and the founders and all those folks, they're kind of throwing their hands up because they're like, hey, will someone take this? We don't want to moderate because no one's ever going to be happy. So we'd like, because, and that's what Jack Dorsey wrote. He's like, he wants to decentralize moderation where you get to control your own algorithm and you get to actually use that to filter what you see from the feed. And I think that's probably the best thing for the future, because you don't want to be like China, where, they have this crazy curated internet that has nothing on it.
Right, I have many complicated thoughts. This podcast has gone on a very long
Yes,
time.
we usually try to
I
keep it under
don't
an
wish
hour.
to continue it and abuse your viewers any more than they have been.
Yes. All right, great. Well, we'll let y'all go. Hey, Tech Bro, do you think I've deserved an IC for this one? Was it good?
No ICs. AmeriFats must fail. AmeriFats must be ended.
All right, well, y'all have a great one. Thanks for joining us. This has been Aaron with the Contextual Intelligence Podcast and Tech Bro with me as always.
Nastrovia.